Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of Jacqueline Duffelin's talk, Historian as Activist, Tales from the Medical Trench. Duffin was a keynote speaker for the Connections and Communities in Health and Medicine, Society for the Social History of Medicine, and Manitoba, Ontario, Minnesota, Saskatchewan History of Medicine Conference, held September 12th to 14th, 2013 at the University of Saskatchewan. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine. It's a real pleasure to be back in Saskatchewan. My first visit here was 26 years ago, and my friends, Dr. Stuart Houston and Mary Houston, were hosts for me at that time, and I've had other visits since. It's a beautiful province, and I'm really honored to have been invited to be part of this symposium. I want to echo what Lisa said about how well-run this conference is, and to thank Erica and Catherine and Aaron and Amy, and I know that there's a lot more people, and all the people attending Moms SSHM. Let's put our hands together for them. You've been doing a great job. I must confess that this is my first Moms conference, although I occupy a place in Ontario, and I was always rather curious about Moms, what Moms was and what it stood for. And then I found out you were meeting with Social History of Medicine, and I thought, well, it's grandmoms. And these are my grandsons. Yes, I have a grandson named Tycho. And just playing with that idea about grandmoms made me think how much our discipline has changed through time, too, just given the way the program has worked. Virtually all the organizers are women. The keynote speakers are women. And it certainly wasn't like that a quarter of a century ago when I set out at my job. And I just want to acknowledge that. It only occurred to me when I was playing with grandmoms. The other thing I want to say for the people who've come from other countries is that Saskatchewan is a very special place in Canadian history. There are dinosaurs nearby. If you need to slip out and go see a dinosaur, please do so. Did you see dinosaurs?
Yeah.
It's easy to get in, right? There are dinosaurs, so don't go home without seeing dinosaurs. And as you heard yesterday from Dr. Houston's talk, Saskatchewan is the cradle of radiation physics and radiation oncology in this country. But what you might not know if you're not a Canadian is that Saskatchewan is the cradle of the Canadian healthcare system, which is something that Canadians value a great deal, and it all began here. So it's important for us to acknowledge that. So formalities aside, at the beginning, I have to confess that I work in a medical school. How many of you work or study in a medical school? Hands up. Okay. A few. Okay. I have a strong conviction that history does belong in a medical school. If I didn't, I wouldn't have accepted the job I happily took 25 years ago, and I hope to convince everybody, the physicians, and also the historians of that fact. Over a quarter of a century, I've been integrating history within the core medical curriculum at Queen's. And I've been very lucky that Queen's lets me do it, because I know that that's one of the difficulties. I do history of anatomy when they're doing anatomy. I do history of obstetrics when they're in obstetrics. And I have two goals. My goals are here. The first is to convince them that history is a research discipline that is of use to medicine, to clinical medicine. And the second goal is to invite skepticism about everything else they're being taught in the medical school. In other words, things change. 50% of what we teach you will be wrong. We just don't know which 50%. Now, students seem to get that, and they seem to like it, and it might be because it's a bit of a diversion, but some of my faculty colleagues really resent it, especially the second goal. And whenever I go on sabbatical, they remove it from the online syllabus. So I have to come back and put it back. And I must say I've seen many, many changes to how medicine is taught, and it's important to roll with those changes if you really want to be integrated. Nowadays, all the medical schools actually do want some form of medical humanities. Not necessarily because they like it, but because they need to have it to get through the accreditation reviews. They don't want to spend too much time on it, and they don't really want to pay for it. And they resent it coming in the form of lectures because too many lectures in a medical school is now considered to be a bad thing. So, if you are a solo humanities person in a soft money position in a great big medical school expecting to be judged on your impact without taking up any time or giving any lectures, you're in a really bad way. It's almost Kafkaesque. Now, with the turn to medical humanities, a small window has opened up for us. And when I speak of medical humanities, I'm thinking mostly of history because it is the first of all humanities. And I see more room for historians getting into medical schools through that window. But the window is partially blocked with the new trend. I have the dean looking at me back here. In medical pedagogy, it's called competency-based training. Now, how many of you have heard of competency-based training? Hands up. Put your hands down if you work in a medical school. Okay, there's a few. Yeah, okay. Just as medical schools must demonstrate that they have humanities, they must also show that they have not neglected the competencies. And you can see them there. We Canadians have very good reason to believe that we invented this terminology, although it has been co-opted as so many Canadian things have. And I'm not going to get into that priority. Our particular version is called CanMeds. It's represented by this little flower, which is actually trademarked in 2005 by the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada. And each of these petals represents a competency. So you see professional, scholar, advocate, manager, communicator, and collaborator, an unfortunate word. All overlapping to produce medical expert. Most medical educators choose to locate their teaching in medical expert, right in the center. Or they'll pick scholar for research. But schools are obliged to demonstrate that they also address all those other competencies on the flower, each one of which is a petal. And they often get lumped together and called the non-medical expert roles. People even have trouble remembering what they are. I play a game with the students and hide all the words and say, what are they? And they go mumble, mumble, mumble. And to avoid the negative connotations of naming them by what they are not, in other words, non-medical expert roles, they have newly been called intrinsic roles, intrinsic to medicine. Now, Dr. Margaret Pelling, in her wonderful address last night, spoke to us about a sleight of hand that took place in the advent of skills-based training to deal with a form of uncertainty. And it was very inspiring for me because it allowed me to think of these competencies, what they are, is a bundle of skills, behaviors, and attitudes. And this lingo actually has its origins in a bunch of uncertainty and loss of respect that was experienced by the medical profession following a bitter 3-week-long physician strike in Ontario in 1987. A philanthropic initiative invited public consultation to try to determine what people really wanted from their physicians. And this was to mend the rift that had taken place and the loss of respect and credibility experienced by the profession. And medical educators have now embraced it. In fact, most of them don't know where it came from or its origins, in a way to heal the damage and produce doctors who do answer to what patients want. I can't emphasize enough how important the CanMeds competencies have become in medical education. Not only in Canada, but everywhere in the developed world. Competency-based education is now a medical subject heading, and this graph demonstrates the number of articles about competency-based medical education that are indexed in Medline, which is the gigantic database of all medical publishing, peer-reviewed medical publishing, and you can see that it really takes off from about 1995, and I stratified it for you for the United States, Canada in red, and the United Kingdom in purple. I didn't know we were going to have people here from Mexico and France, and so you have it too. Just trust me on that. Now, at my school, we have people called competency leads. I call them Knights Templar of the Flower. These are people who will demonstrate to us and to the accreditors where every single competency appears in our curriculum, ensuring that they are not neglected. They are leading this by believing it is a revolution in medical education. And when we go astray, they recite the rules to us. I was slightly worried they wouldn't recognize Charlton Heston, but they seem to get it. Okay. The competencies now govern medical education in medical schools. Just before I left to catch the plane, I got two requests for reference letters from undergraduates applying to medical school, and they asked the referee to address the competencies and the students' equipment for behaving in this way even before they entered medical school. That, for me, is a first. I don't know if you do that here or not in Saskatchewan. It wasn't Saskatchewan. People draw huge salaries to locate the competencies, identify them, and ensure their presence in the curriculum. And the CanMed's flower and its petal has become a governor and a master. Erin has some newsletters that she's just going to pass around. You can send them around. And this newsletter is now published every so often from our School of Postgraduate Studies. It's aimed at residents and people who are teaching residents, in other words, postgraduate physicians, and they are always predicated upon a specific competency. So there's some examples. Now, this governor enforces us as slaves to drag these competencies into our teaching, hauling them around with us, building an edifice of enriched learning where the competencies are the things that drive the medical school. The CanMed's flower is now a supreme building for medical being for educators. It is worshipped in many, many different ways. And it is admired almost fanatically by those who have drunk the Med-Ed floral Kool-Aid. It must not be criticized if you know what's good for you. The petal people at my school decided that all my history teaching, I've been there for 25 years, but suddenly all my history teaching must now be scrunched into one petal, the professional petal. This seemingly arbitrary decision was prompted by an earnest desire to make up a deficiency in that particular competency in our curriculum. On the other hand, a recent Royal College initiative recommended that all history belongs in the scholar petal, in other words, with research. And I want to break loose of those petals. These really are advertisements for Zoloft. History works for all the competencies. But in fairness, it is hard to argue with CanMed's competencies. Those petals are important to practicing medicine. They are good things. But the flower power of CanMed's is beginning to wear on me, stress me, defeat me, frighten me. Indeed, I have to confess, like the svelte woman in this antihistamine ad, that I have an allergy to the CanMed's flower. And maybe some of you have it too. So how to deal with the issue? Because it is a bit of a barrier for humanities people, especially if you don't know about the flower and you're trying to break into the medical school. So a good dose of activism helps, not so much to attack the flower power, but to roll with it, to show that history is indeed relevant to future physicians, and in many ways it might actually solve the struggles of our colleagues who are trying to integrate all those competencies into their curriculum. What? You need a little more manager? Ask a historian. They can come and help you. History does this by asking questions, sometimes unwelcome questions, by gathering evidence, another medical buzzword, evaluating that evidence and drawing conclusions. It mirrors clinical reasoning. It reminds the students that things change and lifelong learning is essential. So, for the rest of this talk, I'm going to give you a few samples of my own historical research projects. All result from uncomfortable questions that emerged in my life as a historian in a medical school, and they were investigated through the lens of historical skepticism. I'm going to make you work. I realize I stand between you and supper, but it's a way of keeping your mind on it. And so I'm going to ask Erin and her beautiful assistants to hand everyone a flower. You get your own CanMed's flower. So in these little vignettes that I'm going to tell you, at the end of each, I'm going to ask you if they address any of the CanMed's competencies. So you can keep it in the back of your mind as I'm talking. So to story number one. Story number one is about the quota on women students in medical school. In 1997, a very famous Canadian historian, who I won't name, was asked about how few women doctors there were in the past, and he archly claimed that Toronto had never had a quota on women students. Females simply just did not apply. to medical school. They didn't want to be doctors. That's why there were so few. The remark really irritated me because I was a medical student at the University of Toronto in 1968, and we knew that our class was different because we knew we were the first class not to have a quota. Women actually made up only 9% of my class because the school was not obliged to accept 10% any longer. So I wondered how I could prove objectively what I knew to be true existentially. A couple of surveys had actually been done across the entire country, and this is the different medical schools in Canada, and it was addressing how many women are in the medical schools. The 1940s are in green, and the 1960s are in red. Well, I don't know about you, but it certainly looks like a quota to me, not only for Toronto, but for all the schools. But I needed more evidence to answer his remark about my alma mater. My class graduation photograph gave me an idea. The number of women in that picture could not be hidden. All the other class photographs hang trophy-like in the main hallway of the Toronto Medical School building. I spent hours counting the number of students and the number of women in these pictures and then calculating their percentage. It was a bit tedious, but it was also kind of friendly. People stopped to ask what I was doing. I caught up with old friends and former students who happened along the corridor. Now, I must concede that this exercise does not account for cross-dressing. The results are phenotypically female students. But they confirm the impression of a quota of 10% women trending slightly upwards, except during the two world wars. Right? When finally they start to trend upwards when my class comes along. Now, knowing that it was trending up after that year, I went back to the archives and found a letter from the chair of the Federal Commission on the Status of Women, who had written to the dean of the medical school demanding to know how many women were accepted and did they have a quota. And the dean's reply was attached to the letter. He said, "Yes, there had once been a quota in the past, but no longer." He neglected to say that the past had been the previous year. In fact, I think the letter from the Status of Women actually made the quota go away, and the percentage of women began to rise, notwithstanding the fact that there had been a quota earlier in the century. So yes, Toronto and probably all the other schools had quotas on women from the end of World War II to 1968. It was a satisfying project, and I realize there's very few people in the room who will remember this, but I used it as my presidential address for the Canadian Society of the History of Medicine way back in 2001. 2 years ago, I had occasion to remember this work because I was asked to give an annual talk at Queen's University for the annual lecture for the chair of Jewish studies. My husband is Jewish, but I have no other credentials whatsoever to be talking about the history of Jews. The organizers were expecting that maybe I'd find a way to blend my work in the Vatican archives that Tia Catherine alluded to earlier with something Judaic. And then someone came and suggested that I talk about Maimonides, but I'm not a medievalist, and I decided I shouldn't go there. So instead, I decided to do some sleuthing. I had long wondered how Queen's University, where I came from, had handled the admission of Jewish students. Queen's has its origins in Scottish white Presbyterian founders, and our national reputation, I must say, is not especially diverse. Poking around the histories of Canadian Jewry turned up a really good story. In 1912, four Jews went to Ottawa. And this is not a joke. Okay. They went to Ottawa to argue that Queen's did not deserve to be a national university because it had decided to define itself on its charter as distinctly Christian. The members of Parliament deliberated upon this and agreed with the Jewish delegates who had come to complain. But then they reversed their stance almost immediately by saying that Queen's could reserve the right to exclude whomever it wished. So I knew that in 1912, 100 years ago, we had no Jews in the entire university. But I can now show you 101 years later, we have a Jewish principal, we have a Jewish dean of medicine, we recently had a Jewish mayor, there's a Jewish head of the Royal Military College just across the bay, etc., etc. So the question was, how did we get from none to many? And this is a bit of a joke on a famous Canadian book, the title of which is None is Too Many, which describes Canada's very lax willingness to accept Jewish refugees during the Second World War. The story seemed to be a little bit different at Queen's, which made it interesting. Now, Queen's also has a generous benefactor, Alfred Bader. He has given us Rembrandt paintings, and he has given us this castle in Kent, England, because he says Queen's let him in to university when no other school would do so. Queen's loves this story and celebrates this story. You can imagine it's about how great and diverse we were in 1941. But I confess I've always been skeptical, a little bit suspicious about it. Forgive me, that's true, and I think it comes from the historian in me about how true is that or how typical was that as a story. Now, remembering my quota on medical women, I decided to count all the Jews in the Queen's Medical School through time. But you will quickly realize that I could not use photographs for that particular purpose. Fortunately, Queen's has kept all the registration cards of all the students for 150 years since its founding. And yes, indeed, I remember this, registrants had to declare their religious denomination and local church until 1980. And why did I think of that? Because I had to do that when I entered Toronto Medical School. It's not that Queen's was different. So more monastic work going through over 4,000 registration cards a year ago last summer, I could find the Jews. And given their names, I could then identify them in the photographs, because we keep all the photographs too, right? The first Jewish medical graduate of Queen's University was Ralph Salzberg, who picked his MD up in 1918. And thereafter, Jews were admitted at a persistent, though rather low rate, until they increased steadily to the class of 1942. That was admitted in 1942. And the Jews are circled in red after I had found their cards. During that period, when we had a maximum admission of Jews in the class, there were very strict quotas on Jews entering the University of Toronto and the University of McGill at Montreal, cities with much, much larger Jewish populations than Kingston. Schools in the United States were also hostile to Jews. A Columbia medical dean wrote on an applicant's file, quote, probably Jewish, but no unpleasant evidence of it. In 1935, a medical dean at Yale recommended that that school never take more than 5 Jews. The attitude that his remark reflected sparked the well-known joke about the Yale crest with its Hebrew letters. If you can read it, you can't get in. This kind of discrimination, which was endemic throughout North America, was one reason why Jewish hospitals were founded in American and Canadian cities at that time, and why eventually the Albert Einstein School of Medicine was founded in the Bronx and opened in 1955. So from 1920 on, many of the Jewish students that came to Queen's, I knew from their registration cards, had home addresses in Toronto, Montreal, and many American cities. Queen's was clearly letting them in. That class that was admitted in 1942 had 20%, fully 20% Jews, which was much, much higher than the town's population. And it was only a year after Alfred Bader, remember our benefactor, that was only a year after he had been let in. So I grudgingly had to admit that he was right. Compared to other places, Queen's was relatively open. But then, the very next year, the number plummeted to zero. And I noticed something startling about these much lower numbers when I went back to look at the cards. The admissions cards added a new question. Race. It hadn't been on the earlier cards. At first, you can see it really is an addition. It had to be typed separately onto each card. But eventually, it was pre-printed onto the cards, as you see here. The race question was asked for 6 years, from 1945 to 1951. Students, they didn't have to do this before, but they now had to state both their race and their religion. Consequently, we have a very interesting collection of how 300 young people thought of themselves in terms of race during that period. And you can see that this particular student thought of himself as a Canadian by race. He was not an Aboriginal. Not one of these students was able to come up with the word Caucasian. They couldn't answer that. Three declared that they were Anglo-Saxon. Jews usually answered Jewish religion, Jewish race. Sometimes they said Hebrew religion and Jewish race, or vice versa, Jewish and Hebrew. But the majority declared their race to be Scottish, or Irish, or my favorite, Welsh. As if they were terriers and hounds and spaniels. In 1951, Ontario passed its first human rights legislation banning discrimination on the basis of race, and the question had to be removed. The students had been lobbying to have it removed, and finally it was. So, this story about Jews revealed two things. Bader was right about Queen's relative openness in the early 1940s, but his positive experience failed to show that yet another quota, this time on race, began right after World War II and persisted until the government, elected by the citizens, forced the university to make it go away. So now, here's the moment you've been waiting for. Over to you. Do these two history research projects about quotas have anything to contribute to the CanMids flower? Do they answer any of the competencies? Are they relevant to medicine? I'm waiting. You can't have dinner until you start talking. Health advocate, because?
Because you're recognizing that there's a quota, and maybe there's a quota in healthcare as well.
Sure, good point. Anyone else got a competency that might have been addressed?
Scholar is an obvious one.
Thank you, yeah. It was research, right? Anything else?
Communicator.
Communicator, because? Right, my work in communicating the story. There's also a communication going on about the school and its requirements as it commutes with prospective future physicians about, are you clubbable? Right? Okay, you're doing pretty well. Ready for another? Yeah? The stories are going to be shorter, the next ones. So in keeping with the theme of physician identity, in 1999 I was asked by some medical students, led by Dave Messenger, who is now an emergency doc working in our emergency room, about the history of tuition fees. The staunch conservative, Mike Harris, was elected Premier of Ontario in 1995. It's all right, down over there. In his scorn for public support of higher education, he chose a minister of education who had been a high school dropout. It's true. 4 years later, medical tuition had quintupled. The students were furious. They felt it was a venal cash grab. The students asked me to explain to them the history of tuition to learn whether the hikes were extraordinary or not. Never before has tuition gone up so much and so quickly, they thought and hoped and wondered. So I warned Dave that I might end up telling him it was simply an overdue market readjustment to correct a failure to keep up with inflation. Maybe we'd just been letting it drift down relative to money. He understood what I meant by that, but he asked me to go ahead anyway. So I thought, okay, I'll just go look it up. But alas, nothing had been published on the subject, and I had to go to the archives to dig out all the tuitions passed in the printed calendars for Queen's University. And on a roll, I ended up doing it for Toronto and University of Western Ontario as well. So more hours of monastic toiling. The results showed an exponentially rising curve. No surprise, right? Here you see Queen's University medical tuition through time, but it was actually superimposable upon the tuition of Toronto and Western, so I'm showing you only one. So I was thinking, okay, well, I can answer the medical students and say, you want to know the history of medical tuition? It went up, thank you very much, and sit down. But the results got way more interesting when I converted them to dollars of equal value. For a long time, medical tuition in these three Ontario medical schools hovered around $2,999. That was the year I was doing the research. And then suddenly it rose sharply. And when was that? You got it. Right after the Mike Harris election in 1995. So the scales fell from my eyes, and I thought, really, the students are onto something, because this is an unprecedented hike in medical tuition fees. But again, I was slightly suspicious that these numbers might not really reflect buying power in the earlier time period. So I went looking for an occupation that existed in the 19th century that we still have now, for which we have data. Any guesses what I found? People always come up with lawyers and teachers, and I wasn't looking for professions. I was looking for an ordinary occupation. Okay, I'm going to answer that one for you, because you still have to do the flower work at the end, okay? I found carpenters. It's almost biblical. But we actually have carpenter wages going way back from the wonderful statistics of Canada. And I had to do some conversion because they worked much longer work weeks in the 19th century and longer days. So I went with hourly wages for carpenters. And carpenter hourly wages have also increased through time. But if we express medical tuition in terms of hours of carpenter labor, by dividing the tuition fees I showed you by carpenters' hourly wages, you see something completely different. You can see that the fees steadily declined from a high of about 700 hours of carpenter labor for a single year of medical school across the 19th and 20th century to a low in the 1970s when I was the dequoted female medical student in medical school down there, when all the deans who were raising tuition had also been medical students, and you could earn everything you needed in your summer job to get you through medical school. And then we elected Mike Harris and, oops, I did that out of my enthusiasm. I clicked it too fast. We elected Mike Harris and the fees shot up. So the implications, of course, are that this might be another quota, one based on socioeconomic class. Now, to my amazement, the CMAJ actually published this article, and it even generated cover art with a picture of a student standing on a stack of $20 bills and still not reaching the handle of the door to the medical school. Medical students across the province were so excited that I got invited to every medical school in Ontario that year. They also invited their deans. And to a man, they were all men. Sorry. The dean stayed away. Now, I keep these graphs up to date. You can see that tuition fees have been outstripping carpenter wages, and except for a two-year wage freeze that was promised by Dalton McGuinty when he was elected, the graph continues to spiral upward. So now, over to you again. Is this research of any use in medical education? Does it have anything to do with the competencies in the CanMed's flower? So have you got your flower? Is it related? Are any of these competencies part of...
Professional,
sure.
Manager.
Collaborator. Not the World War II kind, yes. Right, okay. Cool with that? Any other ideas?
Health advocate.
Sure, health advocate. I think actually having all our medical students come from a privileged socioeconomic background makes it really difficult for them to understand how poverty is a social determinant of health or to inspire them to do research along those directions. So you're ready for another? Okay, you're doing pretty well. Irfan Dalla was one of the students who knew of my tuition fee work. He was a medical student at the time. And he went on to grow up and graduate and specialize, and he's now a professor at the University of Toronto, and he works at St. Michael's Hospital. And he came up with another challenging question for me. He wanted to know, what is the history of the income of Canadian physicians? And again, a quick check confirmed that almost nothing had been published on the subject. And once again, I was off counting beans. This time, my sources came from two places. The annual census of Canada, which, as you know, has just become an endangered species. And the annual reports of the Receiver General, which are published every year, called Taxation Statistics. The tax statistics are really great because they contain the earnings declared as income for tax purposes. But their utility ends in 1992 when someone decided and the law changed that forcing taxpayers to state their occupation was far too intrusive. So we have the statistics. We just don't know which occupation is earning which money anymore. I learned that people always report a much lower income to the census taker than they do to the tax man. I didn't know that. And it's not necessarily because of lying, but because they forget about their other earnings, such as interest from bank accounts, securities, inheritances, real profits from selling things, and dividends. So from these two sources, I gathered MD income through time, and I gathered the average earnings of all Canadians, or what could be called the GDP per capita. So are you ready? They're going to get the results. Here they are. You see two values for doctors on top and lower down two for the average citizens. The higher earnings for each, the doctors and the citizens, represent that was reported to the tax collector. And the lower value is what they reported to the census takers. And yes, these results are corrected for inflation. They are all expressed in dollars of equal value, $2,005. Now, in making these graphs, something surprising leaped out at me on the doctor income curve. How awake are you? How hungry are you? What do you see? Do you notice what it is?
Medicare.
Good. Who said that? A little bit of applause. And it wasn't fair to ask the people who aren't Canadian that question, but this 25-year period is the time period from when Medicare was first adopted here in Saskatchewan in 1962, and it took 25 years to complete the task in 1987 in Ontario when the doctors were so annoyed they went on strike. The strike that led to the CanMeds flower. So we see that the advent of Medicare led to a big jump in medical income. And we see that immediately after the big jump, it fell relatively to the high point in the 70s and 80s, but it has gradually been climbing until it probably exceeds the high point that it had. We can only extrapolate for what the tax statistics might show. I don't think that's too much pie in the sky to suggest that it would look like that, because the tax statistics graph parallels the census graph. So I think it's a fair estimation. But Canadian doctors really hate it when I talk about this, and they don't like being compared to average citizens. Who do they prefer for their wage comparisons? Carpenters? Plumbers? Some of them, yeah. They say, my plumber is rich. Bankers? Who do you think they want to be compared to? Yeah, they do want that. We can't get the dead on lawyers any better than on
American doctors.
You got it. They want to be compared to American doctors. Aren't you lucky we still stay here in Canada? Those American doctors are rich. But getting data on American physician income is even harder than it is for Canadians, partly because they don't have a single payer system, so you can't collect it in any kind of way. And so you have to rely on random surveys that are done on a voluntary basis by academics or the AMA, and there are a number of these surveys. And a lot of the problem with them is that they are responded to by people who are annoyed. People who feel they are underpaid. And so it skews the data. So the blue line on this graph is an amalgam of all the surveys I could find on American physician income through time, and again, with reservations about how reliable it is, which suggests that U.S. doctor income has plateaued recently, and there is some literature to support that hypothesis, while Canadian MDs may be catching up. And again, without the tax statistics in 1992, we can only make an educated extrapolation as to the current Canadian levels, but the conclusions are clear. Canadian MDs earn less, but not a lot less than American doctors. And more importantly, Medicare helped. But this particular story does not end here. I had a really hard time getting this research into print. Both the CMAJ and the Canadian Journal of Public Health rejected my paper without peer review. The CMAJ rejected it in one day. That was hugely disappointing. And during that time, the Ontario Medical Association began a vigorous advertising campaign. Whoops, I forgot to show you that. Here it is. Which they trotted out several times since. Those of you from Ontario will probably recognize these ads, which have been on television, in newspapers, in the subways, and in bus shelters. And I show them to students who aren't too sure what exactly they are advertising. Do any of you have any idea what this is advertising? Your life is our life's work. It's the motto.
Adding value to what doctors do.
Right. It's corporate image advertising. The result is that it's supposed to make patients love their doctor. And Richard over here has depression. And he said it was terrible. He couldn't function until he met Dr. Goldblum. And Dr. Goldblum says, when I met Richard, his depression was profoundly palpable. And then Dr. Goldblum helped him get better. And Richard is happy because Dr. Goldblum is still his doctor 20 years later. Now, this was going on in Ontario where a lot of people don't have doctors. But it meant that if you had a doctor, you loved your doctor. It's been trotted out 3 times since it was invented. It has won advertising awards. Why do they trot out this ad? When do they use it? Why would they bother?
They're going to strike. It reminds me of union advertising when they're getting ready to go on strike.
Precisely. Well, it is when they're getting ready to negotiate the fees with the government, because medical fees are negotiated. We don't keep the same fee all the time. And it has effectively nipped any public complaint about doctors' fees going up. It's remarkable how effective it is. There's almost no public commentary on the fact that doctors' fees are going up. And when I clipped this out, it was in the 2008-09 recession, where most Canadians were experiencing a decline in income, and yet some of the richest of Canadians were going to get a raise. It works. Doctors want more money, and yet, given the reaction to my paper, they don't really want you to know what they're paid. So depressed by the negative reception of my work, I happened to read the paper for the American Association for the History of Medicine meeting in 2010. And that year we met at the Mayo Clinic. And an editor from the American Journal of Public Health happened to hear my paper. And to my amazement, it got published in that August journal. The editors are hoping for a better system in the United States, and they tend to lean to the left of the American spectrum. And they thought that this article on what happened to Canadian doctors might allay fears among American medics that universal health care would lower their wages. That's what they were worried about. Alas, no one notices it. And I looked it up just before I came out here, and according to the Science Citation Index, this article has been cited once only by Canadians. Irfan Dalla, the guy in the last story, right? So it's not doing much business. Okay, ready? Over to you again. Does this story have anything to do with the CanMed's competencies?
Professional.
Professional again, right? You think I should be scrunched in that pedal?
No.
No? So someone help me out of that pedal.
Health advocate.
Health advocate, indeed.
Scholar.
Scholar. Manager. Manager of our healthcare system. I mean, we've got this mysterious piece of the pie that goes to physicians, but we don't really know how it is meted and doled out.
Communicator.
Communicator? Yes, right. And the research, I think the story with getting it published is also part of the story in how reluctant Canadian physicians were to let me publish it. You ready for another? This one's short. Let's briefly look at a disease. Okay. We're aware that there's been an increase, even an epidemic, some people say, of hepatitis C, and that it began in the 1990s. This angry protester was holding the government responsible, and he's standing in front of the House of Commons in Ottawa objecting to his hepatitis C seroconversion. Now, as a hematologist, which is what my specialty is, I've always been really interested in hepatitis because it was one of the major side effects of blood transfusion when I began my training. Once it became possible to test donor blood for the presence of hepatitis A and B, the incidence of post-transfusion hepatitis began to fall, as you see in this graph. And the different colors represent the different kinds of hepatitis. After 1990, when the hepatitis C virus was cloned and we could finally test for it, before 1990, we called all that was not A or B, we called it non-A, non-B. It's like the non-medical expert roles, because we didn't know what it was. But after we cloned the virus for hepatitis C, and I realize I have an expert in infectious disease listening to me here, it's a bit scary, we were able to test for hepatitis C, and we basically mopped up the last bit of post-transfusion hepatitis. And it really is a medical success story because hepatitis after a transfusion is a rather rare event. Yet somehow, if you look, go to the Canadian public health statistics, Canada saw a massive rise in hepatitis once again, and hepatitis C is the orange stuff on the right. Many people contended that that 1990s outbreak came from transfused blood or blood contamination, like you heard about at noon today, from sharing of needles. Now, I could not reconcile... I could not reconcile these two graphs. Which is correct? Rapidly going down or rapidly going up? Again, the explanation was found in the media. And the role of a very important royal commission into the contamination of blood products. Distinguished jurist Horace Creever began his investigation in 1994 by examining how HIV got into the Canadian blood supply. But he was quickly convinced by an angry public, including that fellow who was standing on the hill in Ottawa, that he also had to look into hepatitis C. In his final report of 1997, he recommended that every Canadian who had seroconverted to HIV or hepatitis C following a blood transfusion should be eligible for $10,000 in compensation. What happened was an outpouring of people who had ever received blood but were not sick coming forward to be tested. The incidence of chronic liver disease following hepatitis C seroconversion ranges between 4 to 10%. So, in fact, the epidemic of hepatitis C was an epidemic of a positive lab test. The majority of these people at the time were not sick at all, and we didn't know which ones were going to go on to progress to sickness. So the epidemic had actually been created by Horace Creever. Now, he has read this research, and he does not dispute it. So, over to you again. Is this research of any use in teaching the CanMeds competencies? Communicator,
health advocate,
scholar,
professional.
Yeah. You're doing so well. Okay, and you're hypoglycemic at this point. So, can you stand one last example? Yeah. Okay, great. This project came along in late 2010 from my patient Heather. Heather was a 50-year-old widow and a mother of two who was taking chemotherapy for metastatic breast cancer. The treatment made her very, very sick. One day, she told me that she could not obtain the medicine that helped her nausea, which was a side effect from her cancer drugs. Her pharmacist, she said, told her that it was no longer available. I could not believe my ears. That drug was old. It was as old as I am, and it was very reliable. So I immediately got on the phone, and I stroppily demanded to know what was going on. And the pharmacist replied in dulcet tones, that's right, doctor. None is available in our entire city, and no one really knew why. And he suggested to me that I could prescribe a newer and much more expensive drug, one that didn't work for Heather instead. I immediately smelled a rat. Can you guess what the rat was that I was smelling? Yeah, drug companies. I immediately thought Big Pharma is buying up all the cheap old generic drugs, just letting them go away and forcing us to start prescribing the expensive ones. And who has time to keep phoning up a pharmacist? Eventually, you won't prescribe the cheap one anymore. You'll just go straight to go. You'll go past go and prescribe the expensive drug, and then they'll be able to say, nobody ordered it anymore. We don't need that drug. So, I started looking for evidence to support my hypothesis, and that was the first step along an investigation that is still not over. This is a work in progress. By the summer of 2011, I was completely confused, and I was having trouble keeping track of all the information that I was finding, and I was exasperated by the lack of attention from the media, the medical profession, and the provincial and federal governments. Now you can all not get out your handkerchiefs, you can get out your devices. It's okay. And Google Canada drug shortage if you want. You're allowed to do it now. I won't be offended if you're looking at it. But it's out there. I began the website, CanadaDrugShortage.com, and it is a clearinghouse for information as well as a place for people to blog about their woes. The website is also a historical research tool. So far, I've shown that this is a vast problem affecting many drugs, both pills and injectables for a host of different diseases, and the important thing is that they're all generics. And I've also shown that it is a global problem that I am now tracking in 32 different countries on every continent except Antarctica. Attention to the problem goes up and down through time as we lurch from crisis to crisis, and the issue is siloed by diseases. A lot of media attention has been given to the shortage of epilepsy drugs for kids, but next to nothing about a deeper and longer shortage of drugs for Parkinson's disease. So here's a question for you. What do those kids with epilepsy have that the people with Parkinson's don't have? Cuteness is one.
Parents.
Angry, involved, engaged parents. People with Parkinson's are generally old. And not only that, it's hard for them to get around, let alone send an email. They have vocal parents. Journalists always want to sensationalize the story. And the first thing they ask me practically when I get them on the phone is, did anyone die? Who died? Anyone died? And it's really hard to answer that because nobody's counting whether anyone dies or not. People die of disease. And when I fill out a death certificate, I write the name of the disease. I don't write a shortage of a generic drug. They died of the disease that wasn't treated. We're not measuring it. And nowhere is there a box on the death certificate that asks me, did the drug shortage play a role in this death? No, we're not counting. Now, I can show you. This American doctor is said to have died for lack of drugs for his rare condition of Fabry's disease. His widow is actually suing. The much-publicized 2012 outbreak of meningitis following spinal injections last year was a direct result of the drug shortage, except very few journalists ever made the connection. And 750 people fell ill, and 64, as of last Friday, are dead because of that outbreak. And people are definitely harmed. My best example is from a blog post at my website, story number 15. And I will just summarize her story for you. She's a woman who has chronic kidney stones. And she detects the kidney stones because she suddenly gets a fever and pain, and they know there's kidney stones there, but they give her an oral antibiotic, and the infection settles down, and then they go in mechanically and remove the stones. And she had that happen 5 times. It happened again. She's a woman in Manitoba, rural Manitoba, and they told her that they couldn't get her oral antibiotic anymore because of the generic drug shortage. But don't you worry, we'll give you gentamicin. Gentamicin is also an old drug. It happens to be injectable. So instead of popping a pill at home, she had to go to the hospital every day to be injected. Gentamicin has a toxic side effect of affecting the 8th cranial nerve. And she suffered that side effect. And as a result, she cannot hear. She cannot walk because her balance is off. She can no longer work. And it's completely unnecessary. That's the kind of harm. Now, for a long time, she didn't want to talk to journalists. They're always saying, oh, can you get one of your bloggers to talk to me? And they want privacy, mostly, these people. But I asked her if she'd be willing. And finally, she did agree to talk to, Canadians will know, Dr. Brian Goldman, who runs a popular radio program called White Coat Black Art. And he interviewed her on national radio. And then she actually went on TV to tell her story, and she's now talking to an American journalist as well. And I, too, am occasionally summoned for interviews, and what happens is whenever there's a media event, hits at my website go up. This is my Google counter. So it shows you how sort of temporary the interest is. And the only publication that I have so far on the drug shortages, and I may never have another, is actually in the CMAJ, which is the journal that wasn't interested in my work on Dr. Income. And how that came about was that the editor heard me on the CBC radio as she was driving to work, and so I got invited to write the op-ed. You never know what's going to happen. Okay, so in 2 years, 15,000 people have visited my website, and that's small as websites go, but the users give me new ideas and new leads, and at least 11 different causes seem to play a role in this history. I have no conclusions yet for this particular project. It's ongoing, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on how this project might relate to the CanMed's competencies. Over to you.
Self-advocate, obviously.
Thank you.
Yeah.
A lonely advocate.
Scholar.
Trying hard.
That's basically all of them.
Thank you. Let's move quickly on to the conclusion. So, to wrap up, I've given you a few examples of activist history projects that emerged from questioning the medical present. They all posed challenges in terms of sources, but they generated edifying results and often in very surprising ways. And the work was a lot of fun. This ensemble helps to make two other activist points for historians who are striving to participate in medical education. One is about the undeniable relevance of history to clinical medicine. My medical students get it, even if the other faculty members don't. And the other is about the pedagogic fallacy, if not the absurdity, of trying to fit these ideas into a single competency or not. The CanMed's flower is a form of rhetoric. Why a flower? And not, say, a spider? Since trying to take on its tyranny, I've learned of other disciplines that are coping with exactly the same issues in medical education and have become kind of like children who dare to suggest that the emperor has no clothes. A historian must perform a delicate dance to keep her fragile footing on the medical education platform, above the trench, my title. It is not wise to make enemies of our colleagues by criticizing their latest enthusiasms. It is always wise to learn their language as well as the steps and make them both your own. Then the relevance of history might be an easier sell for us, and the medical schools will clamor to employ historians. All you grad students out there. History can contribute to any and all of these competencies and more. It has always done so and always will, if only the doctors will listen. But first, we have to get their attention. Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of Jacqueline Dufflin's talk, Historian as Activist, Tales from the Medical Trench. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.